Lesson 6 is the intertestamental period. The 4 centuries prior to the birth of Christ have been called the intertestamental period. This period gets its name from the absence of content in our present Bibles for these 4 centuries. That is, it is the period between the Testaments. In all fairness, however, the boundaries of this period are the very artificial creation of a decision in 1812 by the American Bible Society when they dropped out the so-called Apocrypha from their evangelistic printings of the Bible. They did that because they wanted to save money, and also because, of course, the literature in the ancient Greek Bible actually covered much of this period. But of all periods, this is packed with perhaps the most influential events. All of these events, added to all of the previous Old Testament materials, is so significant that it is hard to imagine that anyone would feel that the New Testament could possibly stand alone. When the curtain goes down at the last page of Malachi, prior to the Apocrypha, which have been removed from our Bibles, and the curtain goes up in the New Testament, we do indeed enter into a radically changed world. While Confucius, Buddha, and Socrates all lived just before the period, their greatest influence was no doubt during the period. Alexander the Great, a student of Aristotle, who was a student of Socrates, looms very large in this period and essentially changes much of the world permanently. In China, the Qin dynasty, that's Q-I-N by some spellings, for the first time unites all of China and builds the Great Wall. But Alexander unites an even larger portion of the earth and is more important for our interests because he introduced the Greek language far and wide. By far, the most significant thing in this period, which of course built on Alexander's extension of the Greek language, was the Greek version of the Old Testament.
Maybe you should say that again, the Greek version.
But by far, the most significant thing in this period, which of course built on Alexander's extension of the Greek language, was the Greek version of the Old Testament. This Greek Bible, which was the Bible of the early church, was more likely the Bible of Palestine as well, since many scholars believe that Greek had, by the time of Christ, become the primary language of most people in Palestine. That is to say, when Jesus was reading from the Bible in Luke 4 in his hometown synagogue, he was probably reading from the Greek Bible. This particular document is often called the Septuagint, or LXX, which refers to the 72 translators, of course LXX means 70, who supposedly did the work. A most important point, however, is that this Greek Bible was not exactly a translation of a previously existing document, but was a selection as well as a translation. That is, our concept of biblical inspiration must certainly include the remarkable selection that took place drawing upon perhaps 400 other documents. Long stretches of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, for example, are actually commentaries on other documents that are named in the text itself. The overall selection process produced a single, coherent, composite document for the first time. Many people have recognized the unique characteristics of this document. No other religious tradition has a single, most important document of the character and quality of the Old Testament. The impact of this document in all directions is truly remarkable. When the New Testament refers to Scripture, this is the document to which it refers. Without it, the thousands of synagogues scattered throughout the empire would have never been able to attract Gentiles in anywhere near the same number as were called God-fearers in the New Testament. That's a bum sentence. I'll start over. Without it, the thousands of synagogues scattered throughout the empire would have never been able to attract the Gentiles who were called God-fearers in the New Testament in anywhere near the same number as there were. More than any other human achievement, guided by the Holy Spirit, of course, the Septuagint, or the Greek Bible, literally created the early church. 80% of the quotations in the New Testament from the Old Testament are drawn from the Greek Bible, not from Hebrew documents. This means, of course, that some documents did exist in Hebrew. It was not for 1,000 years, however, that rabbinical scholars actually pulled together and published the Hebrew counterpart of the selection of documents found in the Greek Bible. When they did, they followed meticulously the same writings. All they changed was the order. And it appears to be a myth that such a book existed prior to the Septuagint. In Luther's day, there were two major biblical traditions that were considered authoritative. The Greek Orthodox tradition, understandably, stayed with the Greek Bible, and of course the Greek New Testament. The Catholic Latin tradition in Luther's day had considered Jerome's 4th century translation of the Old Testament into Latin as authoritative. Luther didn't want to have to contest the subtle interpretations of either of these two documents and decided creatively that he would go back to the Hebrew, which by the time of his birth had been in existence for perhaps 700 years. The Protestant Reformation, therefore, for the first time established within Christianity the importance of the Hebrew language and culture. Christians and Jews had very early polarized. The Jews in the period of early Christianity, you can easily imagine, tried to distinguish themselves from the Christians who were being persecuted, while the Jews had long before achieved immunity from persecution. This didn't make the Christians happy, for it often meant their death. But this is only one of the reasons for the divergence of the two traditions. Luther's... Yeah. The Protestant Reformation, therefore, for the first time, established within Christianity the importance of the Hebrew language and culture. Christians and Jews had very early polarized. The Jews in the period of early Christianity, you can easily imagine, tried to distinguish themselves from the Christians who were being persecuted, while the Jews had long before achieved immunity from persecution. This didn't make the Christians happy, for it often meant their death. But this is only one of the reasons for the divergence of the two traditions. Luther's decision to use the Hebrew began a very slow process of appreciation for the Jewish tradition, but it would still be centuries before anything like friendliness developed. Indeed, Luther himself on one occasion said that the Jews, if they did not acknowledge Christ, should have their tongues torn out. Meanwhile, regrettably and astonishingly, okay, I'll go back to meanwhile. Meanwhile, regrettably and astonishingly, due to Luther's decision, Protestants have paid almost no attention at all to the Bible of the early church, that is, the Septuagint. In our seminaries today, this great achievement of the intertestamental period, which had such great influence in the entire ancient world, and which is the foundation of the New Testament, Greek documents, is almost totally ignored. It's not routinely studied in the curriculum at any point. The Old Testament department focuses exclusively on the Hebrew Old Testament, following Luther, while the New Testament department, which employs Greek, focuses exclusively on the Greek New Testament, not the Greek Old Testament. Scholars have noticed that the New Testament at any point makes no reference to translators, even though Jesus' ministry takes him into the area of the Decapolis, which was a cluster of 10 Greek-speaking cities north of Nazareth. This is one more reason why it is widely understood that Jesus could speak Greek, likely even as a primary language. Just in general, the amazingly different world we encounter in the pages of the New Testament is mostly the result of events of the intertestamental period. Many Jews had been transported to Babylon early in the period. The Jewish commentaries on the Bible, called the Talmud, give credence to the thought that most of the Jews never got back to Palestine, even by Jesus' day. The Babylonian Talmud is a huge shelf of books compared to the Palestinian Talmud, which is very much shorter. In addition, there were perhaps 1 million Jews in northern Egypt, as well as perhaps another 9 million in the rest of the Roman Empire. For the most part, they kept the faith, and as Peter remarked in the book of Acts, Moses is preached in every city. Thus, the setting of the New Testament is by no means a start-from-scratch situation. It is more likely like a tinderbox. By understanding the situation, the phrase grows on us that Jesus was born, quote, in due time. When his first sermon in Luke referred to Old Testament events which Gentiles were blessed of God, we can see the base continuity between Jesus and Paul, despite the fact that some scholars make Paul out to be the promoter of a substantially different religion. Due to events in the intertestamental period, the Jews had already achieved a special dispensation from the Roman Empire to worship their own gods in their own way. In all the empire, the Jews were the only group that had achieved that kind of recognition. They had fought desperately for their autonomy in the intertestamental period, and while they had finally pretty much accepted the Greek language, they had never forgotten the desecration of their temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a Greek. Oh boy. Ever since I had this stroke, I just can't talk very well. In all the empire, the Jews were the only group that had achieved that kind of recognition. They had fought desperately for their autonomy in the intertestamental period, and while they had finally pretty much accepted the Greek language, they had never forgotten the desecration of their temple by Antiochus Epiphanes. Their reaction was so strong that they were able to gain a begrudging recognition by the Roman Empire itself. It may be difficult for Christians to acknowledge, but the Jewish families which had fanned out across the Roman Empire, due now no doubt to commercial activity, were nevertheless respectable people. That's why their synagogues were able to attract the God-fearers already mentioned. Hugh Schoenfield, a prominent Jewish scholar in England, who actually translated the New Testament for Jewish use, insists that Jews were sending missionaries out across the empire 100 years before Christ was born. This is no doubt the phenomenon to which Jesus referred when he mentioned that the Pharisees were, quote, traversing land and sea to make a single proselyte, unquote. This, of course, may have meant that they were more interested in Gentiles adopting their Jewish culture than to turn their lives over to the living God. Thus, Jesus went on to say that these missionaries were making hypocrites. Now, that's actually a bad translation, because in Greek the word hypocrite was simply the common word for an actor in a play who is pretending to be someone else. It wasn't a bad word as it is in English. But it is clear, right there, to Jesus, that a shift in culture was not by any means the main thing about which they should have been concerned. Before we leave this intertestamental period, we need to note once more the great significance of the captivity of the southern tribes by the Assyrians. The northern tribes had already been dispersed, never to return as a movement, and leaving a vacuum in the northern Palestine area into which various races would flow, creating the later much-resented Samaritan population. While it was a series of deportations across the years, the deportation of the Southern Kingdom is usually referred to as 586 B.C. What is very important is the fact that soon after it happened, the Persians became rulers in place of the Assyrians. And the Persians, with their Zoroastrian religious views, were much better to the Jews, and it is likely that there was a borrowing in both directions. Persians even allowed some of the Jews to return to their land and reconstruct the temple. In all of this commotion, there's little doubt, as mentioned back in Lesson 4, that the Jewish scholars gained a more specific understanding of a Satan, or a Satan, that was a specific person. Most of the earlier documents in the Old Testament, as we pointed out then, used the word simply to refer to any adversary. On one occasion where God opposes a bad prophet, God is called a Satan. This gives highly important insight into one of the most profound differences between most of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and at the same time underscores the fact that the Jewish people were not the only ones with whom God was dealing and revealing himself. The relatively benevolent rule of the Persians extended for about 200 years, from 532 to 332 B.C., at which time Alexander the Great took over Palestine. Under the Greeks, while the Jews still were allowed religious freedom, Greek culture was nevertheless pressed upon them. Greek domination continued for more than 200 years until the Roman Empire overran Palestine in 63 B.C., during which period the Greek language and culture gained a strong hold on at least the remnant of the Jews who had reoccupied their land. Thus, during this period, we see a succession of outside rulers over the Jews. The Persians were better by far than the ruthless Assyrians. The Greeks in some ways were even better. As empires go, the final rule of Roman law had even greater advantages. The Romans' Latin language did not replace the Greek, due in great part to the fact that the Romans looked up to the Greeks as superior in language and literature. Many of the household slaves in the Roman Empire were actually respected teachers of Greek language and literature. It could just be that some of the God-fearers across the empire who attended Jewish synagogues did so because they wanted to hear the Greek, since in many cases it was no doubt the Greek Old Testament that was read out in the synagogues. It was the Roman legal system, however, which protected Paul and granted him the right to be tried by Caesar when it became clear that he had no chance if tried in Jerusalem. This is the scene, then, in which we enter the New Testament period in our next lesson. This is the scene, then, in which we enter the New Testament period in our next lesson, a scene in which the Bible of the early church is widely known and read over a considerable portion of the earth. Its influence was greatly enhanced by the fact that the Jewish people were the carrier mechanism of that word, their lives and conduct being the most visible meaning of these scriptures. Then as now, it is the actual presence of transformed lives that gives the best introduction to the word written. Minutes, on the nose. The Assyrians deported them, right.
The Assyrians deported the Northern Kingdom, but didn't the Babylonians technically deport the Southern Kingdom? Nebuchadnezzar was a Babylonian, not an Assyrian.
Well, let's make him into a Persian, okay. No.
The Assyrian Empire was on the decline by that time. I thought the Southern Kingdom was taking
Well, now, okay, 532 was when the Persians took over. 586 is when the Assyrians deported the south.
Babylonian.
Daniel.
Isn't that the Babylonians?
Yeah, the...
I know, but Babylonians are Assyrians, aren't they?
No.
Aren't they from Nineveh?
Capital was down in Babylon instead of up in
Well, now what do we do?
Just go back. Like for the benefit of the recording, if you're going to change one sentence, which I think is all you need to highlight, just say...
There were three references that just need to be changed. You can insert Babylonian where you said Assyrian. Three different times.
Well. Now, I don't know, is it feasible, practical, really, to go back? And I'd be glad to do that if you can show me where.
And also, there was one sentence where you said occupied instead of occupied. You're going to fix
it. Well, I thought if you could just replace the paragraph, because you talk about the Assyrians taking away the southern kingdoms, the southern tribes, but and then referring to them as having already taken away the northern tribes, but they actually, the Assyrians took away the northern tribes. And the Babylonians gained the upper hand, and they took away the two southern tribes.
Yeah.
And then the Babylonian Empire was replaced very quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. What I would suggest is, for the purposes of the people who are doing the recording, you're going to have to, I think at the next time, if you were to say, okay, here is, I'm going to read the sentence before so they can find it,
mm-hmm.
and then the new sentence,
mm-hmm.
then they'll, between that sentence before and then the new sentence, they'll be able to splice it in.
Yeah.
You may have to do it two or three times, but...
You just replace that paragraph next time, maybe.
Well, if I'm trying to find the paragraph, it's the trouble. I have one here that says, it was a series of deportations across the years. The deportation of the Southern Kingdom is usually referred to as 586. It's very important to note that after it happened, the Persians became rulers in place of the Assyrians. Now, I should say Babylonians.
Babylonian.
And the Persians were there... Zoroastrian religion were much better to the Jews and so forth. The Persians even allowed, let's see, where do I go? That's one place to change. The other place,
was it earlier than
that? Maybe it was earlier.
It was an earlier time when you said that the two southern, that the southern kingdom was taken away by the Assyrians, and then you referred back to the northern tribes having been taken away by the Assyrians earlier, but the part about it that you should change is that the southern one were taken by the Babylonians.
I don't think I ever, I was never presenting this material in the WCF. WCF.
Probably William Osborne.
Yeah. We had an Old Testament PhD who did all this. This is pretty rusty. When I went to seminary in 1946, Okay, just give me another minute here. Well, let's see. Maybe it was after that. Okay, here we go. Before we leave this intertestamental period, we need to note once more the great significance of the captivity of the southern tribe by the Assyrians. I should say it, Babylonians, right? Yeah. Okay, I found two references. What were the three?
One more.
Well, let's see. Two, three. Oh, I got these pages out of order. Okay, here we go. It's interesting that the Babylonian Talmud is called the Babylonian Talmud when it could really have been called the Persian Talmud. But they were literally in this Babylonian area. Well, now, okay. Did it come before or after this part where I said the captivity of the southern tribes by the Assyrians?
Maybe the third one is after.
Yeah. After.
Okay. Now, if I had my computer here, I could look for the word Assyrian. Okay. I said the Persians were better by far than the ruthless Assyrians.
That could still be Babylon.
That could be Babylon, okay.
No, you could say Assyrians or Babylonians.
Yeah, that's fine. It's fine to say that. Unless you're implying that they took over immediately after Assyria.
Or Babylonians.
You can add the word Babylonian instead of removing Assyria.
I'll say the Persians were better by far than... I'll take out the word ruthless because that doesn't extend to the Babylonians. It was the Assyrians that were really the ruthless people than the Assyrians or the Babylonians. Okay, now I've got three things to repeat, and the two are so close together, I think I'll include them all in one. So, let's, for the record, the previous sentence, the previous paragraph ends with the words about which they should have been concerned. Before we leave this intertestamental period, we need to note once more the great significance of the captivity of the southern tribes by the Babylonians. The northern tribes had already been dispersed, never to return as a movement, and leaving a vacuum in northern Palestine into which various races would flow, creating the later much-resented Samaritan population. While it was a series of deportations across the years, the deportation of the southern kingdom is usually referred to as 586. What is very important is the fact that soon after it happened, the Persians became rulers in place of the Babylonians, and the Persians with their Zoroastrian religious views were much better to the Jews, and it is likely that there was borrowing in both directions. The Persians even allowed some of the Jews to return to their land and to reconstruct the temple. Now, the last correction.
David, the recorder is still on, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Follows the sentence, the Greek language and culture gained a strong hold, at least the remnant of Jews, on at least the remnant of Jews who had reoccupied their land. Thus, during this period, we see a succession of outside rulers over the Jews. The Persians were better by far than either the Assyrians or the Babylonians. The Greeks in some ways were even better. As empires go, the final rule of Roman law had even greater advantages. The Romans' Latin language did not replace the Greek, due in great part to the fact that the Romans looked up to the Greeks as superior in language and literature. Many of the household, quote, slaves, unquote, in the Roman Empire were actually respected teachers of Greek language and literature. Now, I've patched up.